Welcome again to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast live from CFUB Radio in the basement of the Student Union building at the University of Victoria, but emanating instead live to tape via Skype from our home-based studios on this date, June 30th, 2020. Well, as day by day the duration of this COVID disaster grows longer, it becomes increasingly clear there will be no normal, new or otherwise, to return to, especially no economic one. What we're witnessing, my first guest argues, is more cyclone than cyclical downturn, an effective overturning of the entire neoliberal financial order. Not only are we not in Kansas anymore, but Kansas done gone too. Radhika Desai is a scholar, educator, author, and editor. She is too director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group and professor in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba. She's author of the books Geopolitical Economy, After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization, and Empire, Slouching Towards IOTA, From Congress to Hindutva in Indian Politics, and Intellectuals and Socialism, Social Democrats and the Labour Party. Her many essays, primarily on the topics of political economy, culture, and nationalism, can be found at, among other places, CanadianDimensions.com, where her seven-part series, What Is to Be Done? A Manifesto for Politics Amid the Pandemic and Beyond, features Radhika Desai in the first half. And the people of Old Fort don't know what to do next. The small town in British Columbia's Peace River Valley has been under an evacuation alert since June 19th, when a landslide destroyed their only road access. Ken Boone is a Peace Valley farmer and president of the Peace Valley Landowner Association. Ken Boone, and does the Old Fort slide mean things going sideways for Site C in the second half? And longtime Guerrilla Radio contributor and green vegan grandma YouTuber Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things that we've gotten up to in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Radhika Desai and just what is to be done in a world undone. Welcome to the program, Radhika.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris. It's good to at least be spiritually in Victoria again.
Well, it's great to have you on. Radhika, you describe what we're seeing as an economic rather than financial crisis. Just what's the difference?
The difference is that throughout the neoliberal era, for the past 40 years, from about 1980 onwards, we have experienced a series of financial crises. The most recent one was the 2008 bubble bursting, you know, the housing and credit bubbles. Before that, we had the dot-com bubble. Throughout the 1990s, we had a whole series of financial crises hitting one economy after another. There was the tequila crisis, the Russian crisis, the East Asian financial crisis. There was even a crisis of the Swedish krona. And of course, going back to 1987 and the first of the big stock market and financial crashes that we witnessed in the stock market crash of 1987. So throughout this period, we have had a series of financial crises. And the funny thing has been, or at least most people, the funny thing has been that most of these crises have, of course, they have affected the economy, but they have not really brought it to a standstill, largely because basically, even though in theory, the financial sector is supposed to support the productive economy, it had become progressively disengaged from the economy. It was not supporting the economy. So, and I'll come back to that point in a second, but to answer your question finally, it's an economic crisis because this one arises from the economy. Why does it arise from the economy? It arises from the economy because 40 years of neoliberalism has created a financialized economy. You know, neoliberalism said we are going to revive the productive economy. We are going to remove the dead hand of the state from the backs of entrepreneurs and capitalists and so on. And they are going to have the animal spirits restored. And then they are going to invest and everything will be fine and hunky-dory. The problem was the state. We're going to remove the state. That was the wrong diagnosis. In fact, if anything, the state was responsible for the golden age of growth that we saw between the 50s and the 70s. So removing the state actually merely further exacerbated the problem. And instead of actually reviving the productive economy, all the deregulation, the low taxation, the cutbacks to the social services, etc., all this was able to, the deregulation of the labor market, all this was able to achieve was, on the one hand, an over overinflated financial sector, which not only did not help the productive economy, it was parasitical on the productive economy. So imagine it's a parasite living inside or on top of the productive economy. It is constantly draining away the substance of the productive economy. So the productive economy is getting emaciated over time. So well before the crisis hit, people were predicting that the productive economy itself, we are going to see an economic crisis. It would be both demand-led because, financialization has led to more and more inequality. More and more inequality means that more and more money is going into the pockets of those who cannot spend it, do not spend it, whatever, because they have too much money. I mean, how much can you eat? How many cars can you have? How many houses can you have, etc.? So they will not spend it, and they invest it unproductively invested, quote unquote, in the financial markets. And the rest of the population has not enough money to create the demand, right? So there's a demand shock as well as a supply shock, because through this entire period, the economy had become more and more reliant on a few limited types of labor, some very small sliver of highly well-paid labor of technologically highly qualified people, but for the rest, extremely low-skill, low-wage labor, largely in the service economy in the Western countries, and manufacturing economies, which were increasingly being created outside the West. So this kind of extremely unstable economy with supply chains spread taut all over the world, this was not going to survive for very long. And what the pandemic did, it simply accelerated developments that were already in train. So that's my argument. That's why it's an economic crisis, because the crisis now arises from the economy. Neither on the supply side nor on the demand side are things at anywhere near a sustainable level, and both need massive corrections.
Well, and I don't think this is something that's appreciated by most people. If I turn on the radio, the CBC reports the stock market's daily doings as if that is a gauge of the health of the overall economy. The stock market is up, the stock market is down, and I'm supposed to be excited or emboldened or encouraged if stocks are going up. But what we're seeing right now is as our actual economy is tanking, the stock market is hitting the stratosphere. How is that possible?
Exactly. Now, this is exactly the question we should be asking. And if you read, you're right. The CBC and most mass media are simply telling us the stock market is going up, and somehow this is supposed to make us feel good. In reality, this is exactly a sign of just how much stock markets have taken leave of economic reality. Because if you look at the share prices, they have nothing to do with the intrinsic value of the companies whose share prices are shooting up, nothing to do with the dividends that they can pay, etc., etc. So the stock markets have nothing to do with the health of the economy. In fact, as I said, they are parasitical on the health of the economy. In fact, the only reason they are going up is that, and here's a very interesting part of the story, the Federal Reserve, the American Central Bank, reacted to this crisis as it has reacted to every crisis since 1987 by unleashing a torrent of liquidity. And this is done essentially unleashing loads of money, not to give to you, me, or the productive economy, but chiefly to give to the financial sector. Some of it now is going to the productive economy, but we can come back to that later. But chiefly, it is going to banks and financial institutions. So how is it going to them? Number one, it is going to them by keeping interest rates at absolutely rock bottom. They had been rock bottom, as you know, throughout this century. The Federal Reserve tried to raise it a little bit in the last few years in order to sort of save up some ammunition, keep some powder dry in case there is another crisis and they have to lower it. Because if it's already at zero, where are you going to lower it, right? So they had done so once again. So they gave up all those increases that they had made, and they brought interest rates down. And the second thing they've done is what's known as quantitative easing. So what they do there is essentially they buy up the illiquid, essentially unsellable assets of banks. So all the, imagine there are various types of securities. The markets for all of them have tanked. What the Federal Reserve does is it steps in and buys them. and gives good money in return. It doesn't buy them at the devalued price. It buys them at the marked price. And then it gives them, the banks, good money in return. So the banks are once more flush with cash to continue their speculation in markets once again. So, and this is also what creates what's called moral hazard. So essentially, when the going is good, the banks, financial institutions, and the extremely high net worth individuals, they make a lot of money and they keep all the gains that they make. And when things are bad, it's not like a casino where, you know, if things are bad, you don't pay. The Federal Reserve comes in and helps you out. So this is how we have created the unequal economy. You know, Thomas Piketty wrote a doorstopper book saying that this is an inevitable result of capitalism. I would say no, this is the inevitable result of the sorts of policies being followed by the Federal Reserve and following the Federal Reserve by other central banks. It is their policies that have brought us to this point where inequality is so astronomical. Jeff Bezos makes whatever it is, billions of dollars within, you know, a few days of trading. This is the kind of economy in which we live.
And it also leads this government intrusion into the markets, also leads to something, this phenomenon known as the zombification or these zombie corporations.
Yes.
We often see, especially with the Occupy movement of 2000-aughts, the fight against capitalism. How much does what our economic system has come to resemble now, how much of that can really be called capitalism at all?
This is a very, very interesting point. Now, this is where, you know, I mentioned that the Federal Reserve has, in the last round, that is to say since March and April, it has actually been buying up the bonds and equity of corporations or the debt of corporations, is buying up corporate debt. Now, this is something the Federal Reserve has never done before. And essentially what it represents is a form of socialization or nationalization of the sector. But if you remember back in the aftermath of 2008, in a number of Western countries, also government stepped in and had to bail out a lot of companies. But these companies were bailed out, and sometimes they were not just bailed out, they had to be taken into public ownership. But taking them into public ownership did not imply any kind of social control. The governments essentially gave capitalists money in order to run things as they had run them before without having to pay for any of their mistakes or anything. So essentially the government is saying that we are going to nationalize you, but not in the public interest, but in the interest of the private capitalist. Essentially, so essentially you have now an extremely cozy relationship between the state and private capital, in which the state is supporting private capital without controlling it.
Yeah, well, we saw this most famously with the auto industry and President Obama stepping in. But then they said those were loans, and that it's often been said that the auto industry, the American auto industry, repaid with interest those loans of the crash of 2008. So what's wrong with that? Isn't that a good thing?
Well, the auto industry may have repaid its loans, but the question is now whether these corporations, I mean, first of all, the auto industry repaid the loans, but in an era of extremely low interest rates. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you would have to examine the terms. What's happening now is that the Federal Reserve, not the government, but the Federal Reserve is buying up these corporate debt, essentially giving corporations money in a relatively low interest rate environment, but it is giving corporations money in a context where their own business model is in crisis. Okay, are they going to continue to be able to do the business that they are doing? This is the question. Will they continue to make money? What are they going to pay back the money with? And remember, if a debt cannot be paid, it will not be paid. So essentially, it may once again amount to giving money, this time not to financial corporations, but to directly real economy corporations. And so we are now taken one step further of the Federal Reserve actually stepping into and essentially giving money to directly to productive enterprises rather than merely to financial corporations, whether it is airlines or other such outfits, you know, privately owned corporations. So in that sense, we are no longer looking at anything like capitalism. If by that you mean a system in which firms compete with one another, some of them go bust if they make the wrong decisions, etc., because they are not being allowed. They are, as you say, they are zombies. They are the undead. And this is the kind of economy we're looking at. So the real question in my mind emerges is that the extent to which we do this, we have to ask ourselves, why not exert social control? Not least because think of all the ills of the old order that have become clear. The inequality has become clear. The racial and gender dimensions of inequality have become clear. The socially inequitous corporate structures have become clear. They're extremely anti-green, you know, the unsustainable exploitation of resources, etc. The problem with factory farming has become clear. All of these things are clear. Why not, sorry about that, accompany this nationalization with social control over this in order to turn our economies into ecologically sustainable, equal, prosperous economies which create a broad-based prosperity, not just a narrow prosperity for a few people.
Well, I'm getting as worked up, I think, as your dog is there too. Radhika, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Radhika Desai. She is a scholar, educator, author, and editor. She is too director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group and a professor in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba. She also serves as co-editor with Alan Freeman of the Geopolitical Economy book series with Manchester University Press and the Future of Capitalism book series with Pluto Press. Her many essays, primarily on the topics of political economy, culture, and nationalism, can be found at, among other places, CanadianDimensions.com, where right now what we're discussing today is her multi-week seven-part series, What is to be Done? A Manifesto for Politics Amid the Pandemic and Beyond. Well, Radhika, there's another form of an economic model that's doing actually still quite well and overtaking the traditional, I'll say, American capitalist model that has run roughshod for the last 40 years over us. Do you want to describe a little bit about what China is doing differently and some of its other satellites, I'll use the word advisedly, and how they are managing in this strange time we find ourselves in?
Well, that's another very good question. So let me take one step backward first. I mean, you know, basically what has happened in, well, you know, we are told that this is somehow the Chinese virus, etc. All this kind of crap is being trotted out by Western leaders and opinion makers and so on. In reality, yes, okay, there was a first outbreak in China. We still don't know enough to say anything about the actual origins of the virus. But the alacrity with which the Chinese acted in shutting down the city, shutting down the province, isolating it from the rest of China. And then within that shutdown area, they essentially managed to respond with the speed and intensity that was necessary to essentially stop the further spread of the virus. And for that, essentially what you need is what one would call a track, trace, isolate and support model, which means you find out who is infected, you trace all their contacts, you take all these people, isolate them from their context, allow them to recover, treat them in isolation, and then once they are better, return them to the community. And all of this requires a level of organization which basically, Chris, our societies have lost. What do we have instead? We have a give as much money to big corporations as you can in order to overcome this crisis model of dealing with the pandemic. And it's clearly not working. Look at what's happening in the United States. Look at even in Canada. I mean, in Canada, I have to say that our discourse about the pandemic is so self-congratulatory, but on the international league tables, we are among the worst performers. Less good performers in terms of how well we have dealt with the pandemic. What's going on in Ontario is absolutely crazy. I think in BC, you've been lucky. You've had very good, certainly quite decent leadership, and you've been able to deal with the problem. But the other thing is, as well as the China, because it has the shoes on the ground, the shoe leather epidemiology, the actual trained people on the ground to deal with the problem, they have had a relatively limited economic impact from the lockdowns and the shutdowns. By contrast, In the West, we have had to have comprehensive national shutdowns. This sort of thing has never happened before in the history of the universe. And it didn't have to happen. We had loads of warning. We had warnings in the actual spread of epidemics, whether it is Zika or Ebola or various others, avian flu and H1N1 and SARS in 2003. We've had loads of warning that such things are happening. Scientists have been warning us that pandemics are becoming internal to our system. And they are internal to our system because on the one hand, our extremely resource-intensive model continues to invade more and more land around the world, and therefore shrinking the habitat of wild animals, who then come into ever closer contact with human beings and with domesticated animals, particularly in the context of factory farms, where there are all these genetically modified animals that are totally the same as one another. So disease among them spreads very fast. So we have all of these interfaces with them. So the pandemic has been endogenous in that sense, but we were not prepared to deal with it. Why? Because we cut. Whatever resilience we may have had, say, 30, 40 years ago, that is certainly not there. And because we have this, as some people have taken to saying, we have this just-in-time model of production. We have no resilience for the just-in-case something happens. And so we have not had the capacity to deal with this. We do not have the personnel. We do not have the equipment. We do not have the protective equipment. Our doctors, nurses, and frontline workers are dying. It is atrocious that rich countries like Canada, the United States, the UK, etc., should have such a shambolic response to the pandemic. By contrast, the Chinese have the equipment, the personnel, etc., and plus they have actually had the kind of productive economy that we all need to have. And one of the key reasons is, on the one hand, they actually have a fair degree of state control of the economy, where there is somebody sort of saying, well, you know, is everything overall in balance, etc. And this sort of state control also ensured that when, in the aftermath of 2008, they lost a lot of markets, they were immediately able to, they turned on a dime to make domestic investment and eventually domestic consumption the driver of their growth. So the Chinese economy has, in the last dozen or so years, become much more internally oriented. And it could do this because it has a state. It has somebody saying, okay, is everything working? Is everything ticking along well? Does anything need adjustment? Shall we have more of this and less of that, etc.? We don't have any such person overseeing it. The only sort of overall planning we have is somebody ensuring that the very rich people, the financial institutions, are okay. They continue to make the astronomical sums of money they do without doing much work at all. The second reason why the Chinese economy is doing very well is, unlike our economy, they actually control finance. They control finance in such a way that finance actually does subserve the needs of the productive economy and does not, as in our sort of situation, become parasitical upon the productive economy and therefore a burden on the productive economy. And this is a burden now that we have to refuse to carry anymore. If there is one thing that we need coming out of this crisis, is we have to shake off this burden of the extremely rich, extremely lucrative financial institutions. We say, basta, no more. You cannot prey upon our incomes, whether they are profits of small companies or wages of people, etc. You cannot prey upon our incomes anymore. We are going to stop you from doing that, and we are going to have a banking system which actually serves the economy and does not prey upon the economy. So some version of state control for popular welfare rather than state control for financial sector, and a controlled financial sector. These are the two things coming out of this we must have, because only these two things will also give us all the other things we want: a more green economy, a more just economy, a socially just economy in which income differentials are not so great, etc. And so that's why the Chinese model will work. I'm not saying it's perfect. You and I can sit and criticize it for a number of things, but these two things are what it's getting right. And if we are not taking notes, then it's our own fault if our economy continues to malinger for years and even decades from here on. Because, you know, Here's the other thing. I think that we are also reaching the end of the road of capitalism itself. The only way in which anything vaguely resembling capitalism can now survive is through state support. And as you know, I called it in my last installment, the fourth installment of my series, I call this pseudo-philanthropic neoliberalism. So in this model, we can look forward to paying big capitalists loads of money for things they will sell to our state, allegedly to provide to us at low cost or free, but ultimately we'll be paying for all this through our taxes. And they will have risk-free huge profits. And this is not capitalism, basically. This is some sort of a new form of parasitism, this time upon the state and not on the productive economy.
Or maybe a very old one where it starts to resemble the age
indeed,
of serfdom.
Yes.
Well, Radhika Desai, again, the article series is What is to be Done, a Manifesto for Politics Amid the Pandemic and Beyond. You can find it at CanadianDimensions.com. Radhika, taking note, I took lots of notes from the first fourth installments of your series. I only got through the first half page. You have to agree to come on again when the series is finished, maybe in a few weeks' time, and we can discuss more the rest of this series and where we're at, because things are changing so very quickly, and there's so very much more I'd like to talk to you about on this series and this issue generally.
Absolutely, Chris. I find that just keeping up with the news is a full-time occupation these days.
It certainly is. Radhika Desai, thanks so much for coming on the show today to talk to us a little bit about it. And I do look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, every Thursday and Saturday at CFUV 101.9 FM. You're not alone.
Victoria Raging Grannies are singing at the Ministry of Health offices at 1515 Blanchard Street in Victoria. This will be Thursday, July 9th. They started at 11. Their concern is that there's public funding happening for for-profit senior care homes. And, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it apparent that institutional safety, comfort, and care for seniors is in crisis. As of June 1st, deaths from COVID-19 at long-term care facilities totaled 82% of all deaths in Canada. So they recognize that there are excellent residences, but there are also the ones that aren't. I'm guessing they would prefer public funding for publicly owned healthcare facilities that it can be regulated and kept an eye on a little bit easier than the private sector. So that's happening right now. Go Grannies, go! Also today, July 9th, a webinar offered by World Beyond War. It's called Arms Trade 101 and Intersecting Issues. So an opportunity to explore how the global arms trade intersects with other key issues of our time, including racism, colonialism, climate injustice, and militarized policing. So between 1:30 and 4 today, online. And also today, Thursday, July 9th, Negative Numbers, A History of Control, Surveillance, and Exclusion. It's a panel discussion on the history of data collection as anti-Asian racism and Black Lives Matter movement have dominated conversations lately about race across Canada. It's time to examine how the use of data collection can help to better understand hate crimes and racial injustice. So a panel discussion online. You can find it on Facebook, Negative Numbers, A History of Control, Surveillance, and Exclusion. Also online, the Georgia Strait Alliance is offering a Salish Sea BioBlitz all the way till July 12th with a series of conversations exploring different aspects of the diversity of the Salish Sea. It's a Zoom opportunity, and Thursday, July 9th, 1:30 to 2:30. You can go to georgiastrait.org. They'll be focusing on birds. And then on Friday, July 10th, 1:30 to 2:30, they'll be focusing on marine mammals in the Salish Sea. So check out Georgia Strait Alliance for more information on that and other events that they're organizing. Saturday, July 11th, Nature Connection Virtual Workshop with the Sierra Club and Green Team. It's an interactive and educational workshop, and it's available for all ages. You can participate as a family or small group from the comforts of your own home. And Facebook listing is Nature Connection Virtual Workshop. There's a Canada Day group discussion and check-in on Saturday, July 11th from 1:30 to 4. Canada Day is a day of celebration for many and a reminder of colonization for others. They're wondering, does it have any bearing on gender diversity? So this is a place to have that conversation. And between 2 and 4... And again, on the Facebook Canada Day group discussion and check-in. Commercial Drive Car-Free Day is typically this weekend. So Sunday, July 12th, between 12 and 7, there's online activities. That's definitely car-free, I would think, unless you're in your car, but then you shouldn't be on your device, right? So carfreevancouver.org, you can go to and find out what all the events are that they're organizing. There's a Day of Rage Sunday, July 12th, regarding the Zionist annexation of Palestinian land endorsed by the Trump administration, which will allow expanding Israeli sovereignty and annexing over one-third of the West Bank, where thousands of Palestinian families reside. Annexation is illegal in nature, and it's a way that the Israeli state achieves its political agenda of expanding its colonial power. So this is a standing protest against the illegitimate annexation of parts of the West Bank and Jordan Valley that will cause further instability and hardships for Palestinians, as well as undermining chances of the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. People can join safely at the Vancouver Art Gallery on Sunday, July 12th, between 3 and 5 p.m. Bring your masks and safe distance. Monday, July 13th, Direct Action Everywhere is organizing a beach picnic community social. They try to have a fun event every month just for people to get to know each other. So these are people who are concerned about the imprisonment, torture, and exploitation of various animals in different environments for food and fur and entertainment. So if you're interested in meeting some of these folks, you can go to Kitts Beach on Monday between 5:30 and 8:30. Bring your own vegan food and drinks. Sit 2 meters apart and don't go if you're not feeling very good. Tuesday, Native and Invasive Plants 101 online course about the plants of Stanley Park. So an opportunity to learn which are the invasive species and what are people doing to try to remove those and restore the natural habitat in Stanley Park. Tuesday, July 14th, between 5 and 6:30, and that's online as well. That's what I found for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Well, welcome again to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast live from CFUV Radio in the basement of the Student Union building at the University of Victoria, but emanating live to tape via Zoom from our home studio on this date, June 26th, 2020. Well, the people of Old Fort don't know what to expect next. The small town in British Columbia's Peace River Valley has been under an evacuation alert since June 19th, when a landslide destroyed their only road access. It's the second time the road has been wiped out in the last 2 years. Locals want to know what's going on beneath them, but the provincial government has yet to shed light on the geological causes of the slides. Requests for information made through channels have been refused pursuant to Section 15 of the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. Section 15 regards disclosure of requested information as, quote, harmful to law enforcement. Further explanation of how that may be has not been offered, but the geological fragility around the contentious Site C Dam has long been an issue for Peace Valley opponents of that project. Ken Boone is a Peace Valley farmer and president of the Peace Valley Landowners Association. Ken and his family have lived at the heart of the resistance to the Site C Dam project from the very beginning. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Well, now, Ken, Sarah Cox's June 23rd article on the recent landslide in the Narwhal, it brings up two key points that we've talked about in the past, the geological stability around Site C and government secrecy surrounding the project. Firstly, Ken, can you place the Old Fort slide for us? How near is that to Site C?
Well, it's very near Site C. Site C, of course, you know, the actual dam project footprint there is a very large project, but for instance, there's two access roads into the project on the north side of the river, and the slide is almost immediately adjacent to the lower access into the dam project. And the dam itself, you know, I'm not even sure it'd be maybe 2 or 3 kilometers away from the slide. But of course, and the key thing here is it's all the same geological formations. It's all the same unstable land formations.
Well, I mentioned that the government's being pretty close-lipped about what's going on there. And in Sarah Cox's article, she quotes a local there saying that this all, quote, seems really shady. At least we should know what's going on. Have you guys got any information? This article of Sarah's was from the 23rd of June, a few days ago. Have you got any information after that, or is it, are you guys all still in the dark as to what's causing the current slide?
Well, and of course, myself, we're not residents of the Old Fort community who, you know, I would hope are getting, you know, more updates than the rest of us, of course. But as far as I'm aware, there's really nothing new to add other than the slide keeps moving. We heard this morning that the power and phone lines have been severed from the slide now. So, and of course, that happened in 2018. So then now it turns into a real problem, of course, with people not having power down there. And I know some people have evacuated, some have not. You know, it's not mandatory yet. But so, you know, I think the whole situation's changing, daily and probably hourly right now.
Well, this... the refusal to provide information as per the Freedom of Information request that Sarah mentions in her article, that's after the 2018 slide. They still haven't been forthcoming, according to Sarah, about what the causes behind that slide were. This idea that they're invoking the idea that releasing information would be a problem for law enforcement, Has there been any clarification of that statement, Ken? Do you have any idea what they mean by that?
It sounds like a bizarre statement, and I don't think there's been any clarification on that issue. It seems like the various levels of government are withholding their own information, especially, you know, the regional district, who actually are the ones who have to handle the on-the-ground, you know, emergency situation, seem to be kept in the dark by the provincial government. And that was very clear, what happened in 2018. In fact, when the safety minister Farnsworth was up here, he did not disclose that the BC government and BC Hydro were both doing their own investigations into the slide, and that was unknown, you know, to the regional district. So it's very frustrating, especially for the locals that live down there.
Well, and the reports that were produced after 2018 There was pages and pages of it redacted as well. But Ken, do we really need engineers to tell us what the geological problem with building around that area is? I mean, you and I have been talking about this for quite a while.
Well, exactly. That's the Peace River country. You know, the shale material that everything is on here. When you add water, it slides. and even on a very slight angle, and you don't need a steep river valley slope, even just the slightest slope will trigger a slide with enough water. So we're seeing, in fact, right out from our house here at Bear Flat, which is of course upriver from Old Fort and the Site C project. You know, there's an old historic slide there. It slid over, you know, many times, but the biggest one was over 100 years ago. It actually blocked the Peace River at that time, and that was recorded in the Hudson Bay Company, notes from Old Fort. And it's moving again now. In fact, a helicopter, just before I jumped on the call with you, a helicopter was flying around looking at it. And I think the only reason they know about it is because Arlene, my wife Arlene, posted photos of the slide on Facebook. We've noticed. So, and there's another slide a little further downriver happening, and probably, you know, many more. It's just unstable material, and of course building a dam in there just adds to the problems.
Well, there's other dams on the Peace River. Are they in areas that are more stable geologically, or are they prone to the same kinds of threats?
Well, they're definitely in better locations than Site C. Site C, you couldn't pick a worse spot than Site C. But I guess anywhere outside of the mountains on the Peace River, you're going to run into the problems we have here. But the WAC Bennett Dam and the Peace Canyon Dam are basically bookending either ends of the historic Peace River Canyon, just coming out of the mountains, you know, to the west. It's definitely more rock. They actually have a bedrock there, although it has really come out just fairly recently that there is, you know, engineering problems and with the Peace Canyon Dam, which is the lower dam. And those were identified apparently when they were building it, and they had some real problems with that. So, you know, the stability of the Peace Canyon Dam is apparently in question, and of course that is upstream of now where they're building another dam. So yeah, you know, and obviously a dam failure above another dam is not a good thing.
No, this it sounds like a Dino De Laurentiis film in the making here. I mean, the big problem, I mean, as well as the obvious thing of building a dam in this iffy geology, is one thing. But if you're getting slides above you, there's the risk that they're going to be causing little tidal waves coming down the river at you as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Landslide-generated waves are an issue with Site C. And if by BC Hydro's own maps, they show areas and they actually draw lines in areas that could be impacted potentially by a landslide-generated wave. And that is, you know, obviously that's a hazard for residents and even recreationists. You know, who wants to be on a reservoir in the future, you know, if you might be taken out by a landslide generated wave? And that was something that BC Hydro identified during the consultation process before Site C went to the environmental assessment process. The engineers for BC Hydro admitted that, you know, certain areas of the reservoir may be closed off for many years to recreationists because of the threat of landslides and the waves they could cause. So, you know, I'm sure they're going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of that coming at people who probably think in their mind that this is going to be a beautiful reservoir for recreation. And that's probably not going to be the case.
Well, Ken, you and I have talked about this this project for a number of years now, and it was never hugely popular, but there were its defenders. You're mostly people that were looking at the short-term jobs that the project would provide. Well, what's the feeling nowadays, now that this project has been underway for a while? Has sentiment towards it changed one way or the other?
Well, yeah, a lot of layers there. Depends who you talk to. You know, obviously, province-wide and even beyond, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people opposed to the Site C project for a lot of different reasons, and, you know, very valid reasons that have been proven to be correct, you know. And of course, one of them is the economics of it. The economics of Site C, you know, even if the price tag of building Site C does not continue to grow, which it likely is, the economics just continue to get worse due to the price of power produced otherwise coming down. So there's that, you know, and obviously all the impacts, environmental impacts, First Nations and landowners, it goes on. And I've noticed lately, you know, I know people who are working on the Site C project, and you know, some of them are opposed to the project, but it's a job. Some of them support the project for whatever reason, but almost all of them to a person will tell you just how much of a gong show the project is. You know, I just talked to someone yesterday, you know, who is working on the river actually up past our place here. And, you know, and they're always careful what they tell me, because they know who I am, and I might spill the beans on it. But they just shake their head and just say how it is such a gong show, and the costs have to be just going through the roof, and it just goes on and on. And you know, I mean, building a dam in the year 2020, you know, with it, you know, environmental safeguards and all the different things you have to do in 2020 for a normal project, and trying to match those same standards to destroying a valley, you know, I mean, literally you're destroying a valley doing something you would never be allowed to do in any resource extraction or any other kind of project that would ever take place in 2020. So it's almost comical. So, but they still try to match everything they do with, you know, modern environmental standards. So if they can, they'll spend millions to try, you know, basically putting perfume on a pig of trying to meet some environmental standard. And then if they absolutely can't, then they just give themselves an exemption and go and run the equipment right into the river and hose and do whatever nasty stuff they got to do. And meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of environmental monitors hired to make sure nothing wrong is happening or to look the other way. It just goes on and on. You know, I mean, I guess we lived in, you know, for good or bad, we lived in a much less complicated world in the 60s. They didn't do all that stuff then. They did a lot of harm, and in hindsight did a lot of projects we should never have done, but they sure saved a lot of money back then doing it the way they did it now. Now we just throw money at this project, forget about it.
Well, and like trying to engineer your way around, you know, building a dam in the wrong place in the first place. I mean, Ken, the last time we spoke was in September. And then I in the introduction, I'm looking at my notes now, and I quoted Chief Roland Wilson from the West Moberly First Nations. And he says, quote, "Stopping this dam has always been the right thing to do. It would have taken some courage and some leadership, but it could have saved British Columbia billions of dollars and produced a clear example of reconciliation with First Nations." What about the West Moberly? Are they still at the ramparts in opposition to this dam? And given the change of political sentiment over the interim period since even last September, is their voice being listened to any more than it was then?
Well, I guess, you know, has their voice ever been listened to? Obviously, you know, I mean, they have never wavered in their opposition to the project. And despite all of that, you know, they've been steamrolled over with the rest of us. And so, yeah, they're carrying on with their civil case, which will be a long drawn out case. But the courts have promised that their case will be heard before the flooding of the valley. So you can put whatever meaning you want on there. You know, will it stop the project? You know, I mean, that seems likely. Will it change bad law? Well, hopefully, yes, you know, and change some bad precedents that have been set. But yeah, you know, they're carrying on, yeah.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ken Boone. Ken's a Peace Valley farmer. He's the president of the Peace Valley Landowners Association. He and his family have been fighting the Site C Dam project. You made some allusion to it there, Ken, of what it will. You couldn't possibly, with any other kind of mega project, energy project or otherwise, wreak the kind of havoc that a dam project does in this day and age. But your valley is basically a sacrifice zone for energy that it's always been a little bit dubious about who's going to use this power and what the point of this project is, other than maybe providing some political advantage for short-term employment, is all I can think of. Is it any clearer today, Ken, this far down the road, like why this dam is even being built?
No, I don't think so. And I mean, like I mentioned, I think the business case for this project just continues to get worse and worse, as predicted by many experts.
Forget the experts. You and me have been talking about it for how many years now? I'm not an expert, and I don't know. You might be an expert now, but it didn't take a genius to figure it out, did it?
No. It's just sad to see, you know, the money that is being wasted on this. And, you know, and on that front, you know, BC Hydro, every 3 months, they have been, since the start of this project, they've been releasing quarterly reports. And they're always 3 months behind with when they release the next one. But they are now 6 months behind releasing the last quarterly report from last year. And with that one should have come the annual technical advisory report. And we've been told by Hydro now that they will be releasing it very soon. I imagine they'll release it probably 5 o'clock before the Canada Day weekend. And it will also include the latest quarterly report. But what we do know is from the previous one that was released, so the third quarter of last year, that quarterly report was surprisingly candid about the bad situation of the Site C Dam, both schedule-wise and cost overruns. And, you know, they don't give any real numbers, but they give some real clues in there. So we're expecting, of course, more of that come out now. And maybe that's why they've been waiting so long to release it. They don't want to release bad news.
Yeah, well, nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news. And you've been putting out bad news, at least good bad news, in the sense of keeping people apprised through your email notifications of various media goings on. And I receive those. And one of your latest ones, you talk about the residents of Hudson Hope, and now they're starting to feel the effects in a way that I don't remember you and I talking about, but just what the construction is doing to the quality of their lives there.
Well, yeah, they're going to get impacted pretty hard with the need to build a berm along the bank of the river to protect the village, you know, from sliding into a reservoir, I guess. So Hydro's mitigation for that is to build a berm, which means bringing in rock. A lot of that rock has to come all the way from the Pine Pass out towards Hudson or Prince George, because we don't have rock here. So a tremendous carbon footprint, and it's going to be a tremendous truck traffic coming right through the town to dump the rock below there. And yeah, I mean, this highway, whenever I try to describe to people what is going on in the valley, I really struggle for to describe it properly and for the proper words, because just the realignment of Highway 29 is a mega project in its own accord, and it would not surprise me that this short stretch of highway will turn into a $1 billion highway. There's 32 kilometers they have to realign, which has forced them to build road in places where normally you would not build a road. Obviously they didn't build a road there before, but now they have to. And of course, the bridges over the rivers now will turn into mega long bridges over inlets. And for instance, the bridge over the Halfway River, what is now the Halfway River, will be an inlet. It will be the longest bridge in northern British Columbia, 1.1 kilometer long. You know, so it just, it just create every aspect of this project, it just creates more and more madness when you're trying to deal with mitigate all the problems. You know, and right behind our house, they're building part of the realignment that's required for Bear Flat, and the amount of trucking and everything, and the rock they got to use, it's just a mega project and so on. And I wouldn't be surprised it goes to close to $1 billion just to realign a highway, a perfectly good highway that we've already paid for.
It's not just in this, it's not just as you described, the workers describing it as being a bit of a gong show or a clown show, I might say more properly, but I live in Victoria. These types of projects are going on in other jurisdictions, and it's the same thing. Wherever you look, whether it's in Canada or outside of Canada, the time of these mega projects in this an era when we're trying to be more ecologically sensible, it seems well and truly past.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, the world we're living in now with COVID and obviously, you know, having shovel-ready projects that we can put people to work, you know, is obviously desirable. But for crying out loud, we got to do stuff that makes sense, you know, especially in a changing world. And Site C is just so absolutely not that. There's just so much more, you know, we could do as a society in Site C. But of course, this government's locked on down on it. Yeah. You know, and I really do think, you know, the jury, you know, I think Mother Nature is probably going to be the final decision maker on this project. You know, we know they've had trouble with the diversion tunnels. They don't have a plan B. Those diversion tunnels have to work. They say they have them concreted in, but we also hear problems of water infiltration from the bank there and ground movement in the area of the diversion tunnels. You know, who knows what is going to happen at the end of the day? One thing is for sure, we've wasted a lot of money. We could have spent much more wisely on other stuff.
Well, it's only money, right? When you mention the COVID, what about the man camps up there? Bonnie Henry, the health officer for the province, seems to have no trouble with allowing projects to continue with these man camps that I don't know if they're following COVID strictures or not, but it doesn't seem conducive to reducing the spread of this contagion. Are there worries up there about these guys coming in and spreading things around? Are you guys seeing, is your health service up there seeing any stress from it or anything like this?
I must say we really questioned them declaring Site C and other energy projects here essential services that had to carry on. And you know, there was a lot of us who really thought, you know, I mean, those work camps just seemed like they would be an extension of a cruise ship, you know, same type of situation. And we've seen what happened there. But, you know, surprisingly, it does not seem like there's been too many problems with COVID resulting from the camps and people flying in and out because of the camps, you know, and maybe some of that has been hid. You know, Hydro puts out a daily report on the camp numbers and situation. But, you know, of course, you always, you know, I don't really trust them that much. You wonder how many people maybe did contact it and just were shipped home. I don't know. You know, I am somewhat surprised that there has not been more of a problem and basically Northern BC in general, very few cases so that are reported anyway.
Maybe we'll have to file an FOI request, but then I guess that too could prove harmful to law enforcement. So we might never know, right?
That's right. Well, and of course, anything you need to know will all be redacted. So it's a little discouraging.
Well, Ken, I mean, I'm amazed that you're not discouraged. I know that you've got a lot of skin in this game trying to protect your beautiful valley. Before we go, can you describe to our listeners how they might get more information, how they can find out more about this long-running scabrous project that is going to prove so disastrously, if you and I are right and the many other people who oppose it, how they can find out more information about the project and maybe get involved themselves?
Well, yes. If people go to our website, the Peace Valley Landowner Association website, If they just Google Peace Valley Landowner Association, the website will come up there. And from there, if people wish to email me, they can be added to a mail out I do on a regular basis, you know, anywhere from about 2 to 5 emails a week, perhaps, called Sightsee Related Media, where I just put out what's happening out there and different stories and things on Sightsee and other large hydro projects that are going sideways generally. So, people can get information there, and we'll gladly add you to the email list.
So, Ken, well, it's great to speak with you again. And I mean, the circumstances are never great, but we do what we got to do. And I do hope things turn around, and I hope that you guys get some decent summer up there and stay healthy. Eh?
Hey, well, thanks a lot, Chris, and I really appreciate you giving us this opportunity.
Well, my pleasure. Till the next time, then. Yeah, thanks, Ken Boone, to Radhika Desai, Janine Bancroft, and all the good folks that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. There's great programming coming up. You know that, but that's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.